I think it's true to say that in the annals of history, there have been a number of famous debates. You know, all you need to do is think about the 1860 debate in London between Thomas Huxley and Archbishop Wilberforce on the theory of evolution. And then you remember the debate between Edison and Tesla on the propagation of electricity. You've got debates recurring throughout history on the geocentric versus the heliocentric view of the solar system. You have debates on quantum mechanics, on the Bohr model of the atom, on the theory of relativity. There have been so many debates throughout the history of science. But of all of them, only one has been titled the Great Debate. And we're going to talk about that debate tonight. Some have said, like the Holy Roman Empire, that was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. The Great Debate was neither great nor a debate. It wasn't a debate, really. It was a discussion by two famous astronomers, Harlow Shapley of Mount Wilson Observatory and Heber Curtis of Lick Observatory, on the scale of the universe. It was conducted in Washington, D.C. on April 26, 1920. And each antagonist was given 40 minutes to speak. There was no reportage between them, so you can't say that it was a debate. But I will contend that it was great, because this debate helped advance our understanding of our place in the universe and literally the size of the cosmos. And it's amazing when you look back at this debate how little we actually knew that recently in 1920. And we'll talk more about that tonight. But before we get into the debate, I thought it would be interesting to talk for a few minutes on the scene, the world as it was at the time of this great debate. So let's take a look at a few things that I think are of interest. They are to me. Number one, in 1920, the 18th Amendment, which was ratified the year before, takes effect. Prohibition is ushered in, which was the law of the land until 1933, when the 21st Amendment was adopted that abolished prohibition. That year, in 1920, the 19th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified by the 35th state in August of 1920. That state was Tennessee, by a vote of the legislature of 50-49, becoming the 35th state to ratify the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote. They voted a few months later in the presidential election. Because of that amendment, the number of people voting in that election was unprecedented in numbers. The League of Nations was adopted. Levi Morton died on his 96th birthday in 1920. You might say, well, who is Levi Morton? Does anybody know? Yes, the salt heir. No, this was the vice president under Benjamin Harrison, 1889 to 1893. And what's the significance of that? It's interesting. He died in 1920 on his 96th birthday. His life overlapped by 2 years the lives of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. Pope Benedict XI succeeds Pope Pius X. Pius X is the last pope to be elevated to sainthood, possibly because some think he banned soloists in liturgical music. The national debt, $230 per person in 1920. The World Series in 1920 between the Cleveland Indians and the Brooklyn Dodgers won 5-2 in a 9-game best-of-9 series back then under those rules, won by the Cleveland Indians. That series had probably the most phenomenal single game in World Series history, some historians would say, because in Game 5, there were three extraordinary things that happened. Number one, there was the first home run by a pitcher in the history of the World Series. Number two, there was the first Grand Slam in a World Series game. Those feats have been repeated since then. But the third unique feature of that World Series, which has never been repeated to this day in any postseason play in baseball, was an unassisted triple play. A line drive was hit to the second baseman. He stepped on second base. The guy had already started running, and he tagged the guy coming from first base to second. So in a matter of a few seconds, an unassisted triple play. It's never been replicated in the history of Major League Baseball in the postseason. Clarence Metcalf was the one that hit into that triple play. He came up for his second at-bat in the eighth inning. He hits into a double play, and he goes into the midst of baseball legend as having the most outs in two at-bats. To this day, in the history of Major League Baseball. Five outs and two at-bats. So that was the World Series in 1920. The Rose Bowl was won by Harvard, 7-6 over Oregon. And the International Astronomical Union was founded. So it's kind of an interesting year historically. But something else happened that year that we're going to focus on now, and that's the Great Debate. It was held in the Baird Auditorium in the Natural History Museum that's part of the Smithsonian Institution. It's still there to this day. I've seen it. And this is a picture taken at about the time of the debate, so you get an idea of the feel for what was happening. We don't know exactly who was present. We do know that there were a lot of non-professional astronomers present, a lot of lay people present, and a number of professional astronomers, but they did not dominate. Shapley said later in life that he believed Albert Einstein was in the audience that night, but we don't know for sure who was there. Now let's talk about the background of the debate. And we need to go back to William Ellery Hale, who, after the great Chicago fire of 1871, starts an elevator business because of all the construction that was going on in Chicago, multi-level buildings needing elevators because of the fire that destroyed almost everything. He becomes wealthy as a manufacturer of elevators. He purchases telescopes for his son, George Hale, that ignited in the son a lifelong passion for astronomy. The dad endows a lecture series for the National Academy of Science in Washington, D.C. His son, George, goes on to become the chief proponent, organizer, fundraiser for the 60 and 100-inch reflectors at Mount Wilson, the biggest glass reflectors of their day in each case, 1908, 1917, the Hooker reflector, 100-inch. And he was the chief developer of the Cassegrain telescope on Palomar, the 200-inch. He died before it was finished, and he was pretty much in charge of that project and made sure that despite George Ritchie's demand that it be a Ritchie Creighton telescope, Hale thought it would take too long to make a Ritchie Creighton and it would cost too much, so they went with the Cassegrain. Ritchie bowed out and no longer participated in the construction of that telescope. But it was named after Hale because without his prolific organizing skills, it never would have probably come about. Well, anyway, in 1919, there was a proposed debate on the distance scale of the universe between Shapley and Curtis as part of that annual lecture series in Washington, D.C. And here we have a telegram that still exists that was sent by Hale to Harlow Shapley inviting him to participate in the debate. His fee, as it was true for Curtis as well, was $150, which included his travel expenses. To really comprehend the nature of this debate, we need to back up a little bit and talk about another development, and that is the significance of variable stars. This development that I'm going to talk about here for a few minutes just happened a few years before this debate. Now, as we know, as astronomers, which comes as a shock to most lay people, many of the stars in the universe are variable. They're not constant. And there's some very famous examples, of course. Some of you probably have monitored variable stars, and you see the maximum and minimum brightness, and it's very interesting to observe from night to night. That was first detected by an amateur, John Goodrick, in the UK in the 18th century. Interestingly, he was a deaf mute, and his father was part of the British Foreign Service, very respected family, that all but disowned their son. They were so embarrassed of him because of his handicap. I've seen his grave, and it's just J.G., the letters, nothing else. It was like they were too embarrassed to even put his name on his gravestone. But anyway, Goodrick discovered the variable Delta Cepheus, and that was the first known variable star. It became a breakthrough concept to use variable stars as a standard candle for measuring distances in the universe. And as I said, many stars are variable, changing in luminosity over a period of time. The first was the Delta Cephei discovered in 1784. There's a category of variable stars that are short-period variables, known as Cepheid variables, named after the Delta Cephei variable that was found in 1784, which fit into this category. These are characterized by periods of 3 to 50 days, like clockwork from maximum to maximum, and variations in luminosity range from 2% to 10 times. These are giant stars, 1,000 to 10,000 times the absolute luminosity of our sun. We see red and blue shifts in the spectra of these stars as they expand and as they contract. Polaris is a good example of a Cepheid variable star. And here you see a typical light curve for a Cepheid variable, and you just monitor the maxima for each curve, and you can compute the number of days. Well, that's an interesting development that happened. But what astronomers needed, just knowing the light curve of a star did nothing to determine how far away it was. What was needed to measure distances, now keep in mind, we're talking at the turn of the 20th century, of not having really any idea how far anything was in the universe other than by triangulation and parallax measurement. That only took us out for 50 to 100 light years, maybe. It's been more sophisticated since then, and we can go out several hundred, and with the Gaia satellite, probably many, many thousands of light years doing precise parallax measurements. But at the turn of the 20th century, that was not possible. You're looking at measuring objects out to 100, maybe 200 at the most, light years through parallax. The first star was not measured, its distance, by parallax until Cygni 61 in 1838 by Friedrich Bessel, incidentally, a German astronomer. So the point is, you see a light bulb in the distance. No way to... How many of you have been out in a dark site looking forward to getting the telescope out, and there's a street light, you know, 50 feet, 100 feet away? You can shoot lasers at them. You ever tried that? It works on some of them. A brick works, too. You see a light bulb in the distance, and there's no way for you to know its absolute magnitude, that is, it's an intrinsic brightness. All you know is its apparent brightness from where you're standing. The same is true for stars. If you know that a light bulb is 100 watts, you can easily compute its distance using the inverse square law, if you know that. Luminosity decreases proportionally to the square of the distance. A powerful tool. The key point, we can measure distances in space if we can find a standard candle like a 100-watt bulb with a known intrinsic brightness or absolute magnitude. That was the holy grail at the turn of the 20th century. How do we find such an object? The best candidate became the Cepheid variable stars. Now, here's a picture taken with the Sky-6 software of the constellation Cepheus. There's Delta Cephei right there, fourth brightest star in the constellation, naked eye object from a dark sky. But look at this. Here's that same region of the sky without variable stars, and then I click on the icon to show variable stars, and look at them all. I mean, it's just amazing how many variable stars there are. Henrietta Swan Leavitt was a clerk at the Harvard Observatory. She discovered 1,700 variables, including 20 Cepheids from photos of the large Magellanic clouds that she was asked to inspect. She was just chronicling photographic plates others had taken. She was considered to be in a clerical position. But she soon demonstrated an uncanny ability to extract information from these plates that was far beyond what she was hired to do. And in 1912, was actually able to formulate something known as the period luminosity law. And the key point was this. Those Cepheids that she was observing, 20 of them that she found out of 1,700, indicating they're relatively rare even among variable stars, those 20 Cepheids were all the same distance from the sun because they're all in the Magellanic Cloud. So that was very important. And because of that, their apparent magnitudes could be compared because they all were the same distance away. So she discovers that the luminosity of those Cepheids was directly related to their period, from maximum to maximum. The longer the period, the brighter the star. The shorter the period, the fainter, the less luminous the star. The period-luminosity relationship. Here's an example of a photographic plate where she detected a variable star. You see how dim it is on the left side, and how bright it is, the same star over on the right-hand side of the same field. So here is Henrietta Leavitt's period luminosity relationship. If you compare luminosity on the y-axis here with the period from maximum to maximum in days, you can see that the longer the period, the greater the luminosity. It's an invariable relationship. The most luminous Cepheids are the largest, the most energy, and take longer to pulsate, is the theory. She could only correlate periods and apparent magnitudes, however, and that was interesting, but she couldn't unlock any information about distance with this information. But this was very important. In 1917, just 5 years later, Harlow Shapley, one of his greatest achievements, perhaps his greatest achievement, was he takes several Cepheids whose distances had been measured by parallax and computes their absolute magnitude, their intrinsic brightness, using the inverse square law, and then correlates their period with their absolute magnitude. And this is what we see on the right-hand side, this graph, absolute magnitude and their period based on Cepheids with a known distance. He then devises a formula to compute distance based on the distance, what he called the distance modulus, which is the difference between the apparent magnitude and the absolute magnitude. If you look at the difference, the delta between those two, he was able with a table to correlate that into distance. He had a table he called the distance modulus table to assist in doing this, but since then astronomers use an equation so that you don't have to find things on a table. There's an equation that's used. As if you know the absolute and the apparent magnitudes of any object, you can compute its distance. For the first time, the limiting chains of parallax that restricted us to our immediate neighborhood of measuring distances, those chains were broken, and distances to the galaxies could be computed accurately. It's a breakthrough. That happened in 1917. Cepheid variables become the universe's yardstick. And so what happens? Shapley starts examining globular clusters in the Milky Way. He examines several of them. And he determines that they're approximately 20,000 to 50,000 light years away, using his distance modulus table, finding Cepheid variables in many of these in these clusters. He had to, but in the clusters that he could actually find Cepheid variables, determine their apparent and absolute magnitudes using the inverse square law and his distance modulus table, he's able to calculate their distance, and he discovers that all these dozens of globulars he was examining fell in that 20,000 to 50,000 light-year range, which he concluded formed a sphere in the Milky Way, which had to define where the center was. So he's able to determine that there's this halo of globular clusters forming a spherical shape, like a half a sphere, that he determines correctly must identify the center of our Milky Way galaxy. Very interesting. So really, it's not an overstatement to say that Copernicus in the 16th century determines that the Earth is not the center of the solar system. And now Shapley takes it farther and says, not only is the Earth not the center of our solar system, but our solar system is not even the center of our galaxy. It's tens of thousands of light years away. It's the principle of mediocrity, as it's sometimes called. There's nothing special or unique about Earth. Of course, in my opinion, that assertion was severely tested in just the last 10 years by the anthropic principle, which I believe shows the Earth is totally unique. He determines, given his measurement of the distance to the globular clusters, they're all within the Milky Way. And so the size of the Milky Way galaxy, he concludes, must be in the neighborhood of 300,000 light years in diameter, which was so enormous that he concludes this must be the only, there's only one galaxy. The Milky Way galaxy constitutes the universe. There's not any more galaxies. This is so huge, this can subsume everything that we see with our telescopes. 1920, that was Shapley's conclusion. What about all these spiral nebulae that are showing up either in the eyepiece of telescopes over the last 100, 200 years or in photographic plates? I'm not done yet. or on photographic plates. What about them? Well, we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Shapley concludes whatever they are, and he felt they were gas clouds, they were part of our Milky Way galaxy.
Richard, what makes a
It's the period. It's that 3 to 50 day period. And these are not hard and fast rules, but I think that's the best definition of them. And there's some refinement of that, but I always go by the 3 to 50 day. You get below 3, you're talking about RR Lyrae variables. You get above 50, there are different categories of these. But Leavitt and Shapley were only looking at the CFID variables. Yeah. And that's what astronomers use to measure. We can actually measure objects now out to about 100 million light years using CFID variables. That was one of the main reasons, by the way, for the Hubble Space Telescope, to find CFID variables in other galaxies. And we actually have found them, M101, a number of galaxies, tens, if not 100, I think maybe as much as even 150 million light years, but certainly nothing more than that. I've seen a lot of images taken by Hubble detecting these CFID variables. And once you detect them, you use that distance modulus formula that Shapley devised in 1917 to determine its relative distance. So it's just an amazing story. So now we have the means of knowing how far these things are that we're looking at. It was so frustrating not to know that. And it was Shapley's brilliance. Leavitt could not take her data any farther. But what she did was important. It served as the basis for what Shapley would do. Just like Vesto Slipher, his examination of spiral nebulae in the 1920s, he didn't understand what he was doing, other than he was discovering redshifts on every galaxy he measured. He didn't know why that was. It was Hubble. It was the genius of Edwin Hubble that took that data and turned it into one of the most significant discoveries in the history of mankind, that we live in an expanding universe. Not only is it a universe filled with galaxies, as Heber Curtis argued during the Great Debate, as we'll see, but those galaxies are not static like Einstein thought. They are flying away from each other. The universe is expanding like polka dots on a balloon. And as we've discovered in the last 15 years, the Nobel Prize in Physics was granted for this discovery for the dark energy term, that the universe is not only expanding, but it's accelerating in the rate of expansion. That's for another night. You want me to talk more about that? So let's talk about the nature of these spiral nebulae, because this is an essential component of this debate. So we've seen the importance of variable stars and CFID variables in particular as yardsticks that Shapley was the one to extract from that data how far these objects were. And if you can find those in globular clusters, we know how far the clusters are. If you can find them in galaxies, we know how far the galaxy is. It sounds like a Stalin speech before the Politburo. You know, everybody was afraid to be the first to stop clapping when he entered the room because you'd be executed. So everybody just kept clapping. Wouldn't that make you feel good as a dictator? They love me. And so what happened was they had to put a bell in the Politburo hall. When the bell rang, you were permitted to stop clapping. We need that in here. Okay. Dale isn't always like this. Okay. This is wonderful. Okay. Thank you. I feel like Stalin. Okay. So here is a screenshot that I took using the Sky 6. I use the Sky X now. But anyway, so you look at the Sky 6 screen save here. And look at, I don't know if you can tell this, but you see all these little ovals, like right here? There's hundreds of them on there. What are those things? Galaxies. Yeah. This is what was showing up through the eyepiece of large telescopes at the turn of the 20th century and before. In the 19th century, this was true. You know, the largest glass mirror reflector telescope as of 1879 was only 40 inches. Lord Rosse's Leviathan was 72 inches, but that, like most of the large telescopes throughout the 17th and 18th and 19th century, were all what? Speculum. They were polished metal. It corroded on moist nights. It was horrible. Probably better than nothing, but it was nothing like glass was. So, but anyway, these images started showing up through the eyepiece of telescopes and then on photographic plates, even more so, of these little smudges. What are those things? And they were given the name, and you can see it here in a couple of photographs. This gives you a little bit idea of what you know, a galaxy cluster looks like through a large telescope. Doesn't look, I mean, like the Obsession 20, looking at the Virgo cluster, I mean, I'd see 20 or 30 galaxies in the same field of view in a two-inch eyepiece. And it didn't look quite this clear, but not far from that. And then here's a more lengthy exposure. But again, you get the idea of astronomers wondering, what are all these things? And that was the question. They were given the name of spiral nebulae because the first one ever really examined by Lord Rosse of Parsonstown was M51. And let's talk about him. By the way, in 1755, Immanuel Kant proposed that all these nebulae are separate islands of countless stars. How prescient he was. Yeah, just like me. You know, when I took the highest test in amateur radio. Anybody here amateur radio? The amateur extra exam is the third and highest. You have to be an electrical engineer, like a PhD. I mean, it's not quite that bad to take this test. It's a four-hour exam on the minutiae of electrical and antenna theory. And I had to study these manuals. And I took the test here at the NHTSA Fire Department a couple of years ago. My wife took me, and she was going to go shopping. I said, no, honey, you wait here in the parking lot. I won't be long. What faith. So I went in, and I sat down at a table just like this. I was the only one there that day taking the exam. And there were four judges sitting on the other side of the table making sure I didn't cheat. They could barely fit in there. They were crammed in. So and 11 minutes later, I hand them back my test. And they said, are you having trouble filling out the biographical portion? I said, no, I'm done. They said, you're not. I said, yes, grade it. So they did. It was a 94. I could have done better had I taken longer. But it was a four-hour test. And my wife said, you have what is called parakeet knowledge. You say the right, you give the right answers, but you have no concept of what you're saying. And so... There was a lot of truth to that, actually. Hey, I passed the test. That's what counts, right? So I get different. I have more frequencies I can listen to. I can listen to alien transmissions. You can listen to anything. You can, as rank amateurs. But even me, as a highly sophisticated amateur radio operator, I can talk. That's the whole thing about getting licenses. Anybody can listen, but to talk, you need to be licensed. And there's three grades of license. So anyway, in the 1780s to 1820s, William Herschel discovers thousands of these nebulae from the Latin word cloud. Half the new general catalog of 8,000 objects Herschel discovers. Most, as we know, if you've taken the Herschel 400 or Herschel 2, what, 90% of those things are galaxies. Little dots, little ovals, little circles of nebulosity. You can't tell those are galaxies. 1847, Lord Rosse, William Parsons, an Irish astronomer, builds his 72-inch Leviathan of Parsonstown, speculum, metal mirror, the largest telescope in the world until the Hooker telescope in 1917. Many people don't even include it on the list of largest telescopes because it was so limited as a speculum telescope. It was so inferior. But it was the largest telescope until Hooker in 1917, the 100-inch reflector on Mount Wilson. But one of the major objectives of Rosse was to resolve the nebular hypothesis. What are these nebulae? And he was seeing more than anybody had seen before. He was the first person to observe spiral structure in many of the nebulae. We know that about 3/4 of all the galaxies among the 1,000 brightest galaxies in the universe are spirals. It is the most common type of galaxy. And Rosse was beginning to see him with this telescope. Incidentally, you'll notice one thing about that telescope. He had no clock drive on it. So he took images just like the Arecibo radio dish. It can only observe what it's pointing at. And that's the way it was with this telescope. Rosse's son actually modified it with a clock drive mechanism many, many years later. And so here's an actual drawing that Rosse made of M51. Pretty close, isn't it? You can clearly see the spiral structure. Well, in 1920, getting back to our debate on the scale of the universe, there were two interrelated issues, the scale of the universe and the nature of the spiral nebula. You'll notice that the title of the debate was the scale of the universe, which seemed to mean, how big is it? And that's what Shapley addresses in his debate, in his 40-minute segment, is the size of the universe, his evidences for the universe being one galaxy, 300,000 light years in diameter. Curtis focused much more on the nature of the spiral nebulae. It was related to the main issue, but it was really separate from it in a way. Shapley, his main points were the diameter of the Milky Way is 300,000 light years. The sun is not the center. The Milky Way is so huge that it comprises the entire universe. And all these little spiral nebulae that we're seeing, they're just gas clouds that are being repelled. That's causing their redshifts by the Milky Way's what he called light pressure. Light does have pressure, you know. I remember when I was in eighth grade, in a science class, there was a film projector, and it had a movie canister. And I looked over at it, and it said, the pressure of light. I mean, that was a thought that had never even occurred to me before. That light has pressure? And that was kind of a kairos moment for me. You know, in Greek, there's two words for time, basically. Chronos, which is more the chronological passing of time, quantitative time, and kairos, which is qualitative time, you know, an aha moment, a moment of deep insight. That's what it was for me, although I didn't really fully comprehend it at the time. But it just the idea of light having pressure. Let me ask you this. Does the speed of light change when a beam of light hits a mirror and rebounds? I've asked a number of physicists with PhDs that question. You'd be interested in the range of answers that I get, like a bunch of attorneys. Well, that's what I wonder. When you look at a reflector telescope, is that speed of light diminished by hitting the primary and coming up and hitting the prism and coming through the eyepiece? The diameter of the Milky Way, Curtis says, no, it's not that big. It's not 300,000. It's more like 30,000 light years. Of course, we know today that it's about what? 100, roughly 100,000. He believed that the sun was, in fact, very close to the center of our galaxy. But here's the key point right here. Curtis argued that those spiral nebulae are galaxies, separate island universes, separated from ours by unimaginable distances. That was the main point of disagreement between these two great astronomers. In 1920, here's a direct quote from Shapley's presentation. Shapley, by the way, the eyewitnesses who were there that later spoke about the debate, it was not considered a big deal at the time. And some of the people that were there, if you would have taken a straw poll, you would have concluded that Curtis won the debate just on style. He'd been a high school teacher. He'd been a college teacher of Greek and Latin and later math and physics and astronomy. He was a polished presenter. Shapley stood at the lectern and read his notes. It was boring. It was uninspired. It was unimpressive. In fact, after the debate, Curtis wrote Shapley and said, you need to hone your presentation skills. And he gave him some pointers. But this is one of the things from Shapley's notes. From the new point of view, our galactic universe appears as a single, enormous, all-comprehending unit, the extent of which seems to be indicated through the dimensions of the widely extended assemblage of globular clusters. The adoption of such an arrangement leaves us with no evidence of a plurality of stellar universes. Even the remotest globular clusters do not seem to be independent organizations. The hypothesis that spiral nebulae are separate galactic systems now meets with further difficulties. So long as the diameter of the galactic system was thought to be only a few thousand light years, we had a fairly plausible case for the island universe hypothesis. But any external universe must now be compared with a galactic system, probably more than 300,000 light years in diameter. Was he right? Absolutely not. And so here we see an article by Curtis written just a few months after the debate, Modern Theories of the Spiral Nebulae, for the Journal of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, presenting his view in more detail that those spiral nebulae were nothing less than other galaxies in the universe. A universe of galaxies is what he described. He was absolutely correct. As recently as 1920, this is the thing that never ceases to just amaze me. As recently as 1920, the true nature of our universe was not understood at all. And then Edwin Hubble begins to examine the Andromeda Galaxy, M31, with the new Hooker 100-inch telescope at Mount Wilson, and everything changes. Here's a picture I took of M31. So you can see from looking at that, how do you resolve that into, how do you know there's 400 billion stars in there, or a couple hundred billion solar masses? Since the sun is bigger than 85% of stars, there's who knows how many hundreds of billions of stars there are actually in. I don't like using solar masses because I don't think that's accurate. That's really diminishing the number of stars in the galaxy. We don't, just like our galaxy, there are probably trillions of stars in our galaxy. Most of them are red dwarfs or brown dwarfs, which we can't even see. But we, astronomers estimate there are probably 30 red dwarfs for every G-class star like ours. We can't see. Very few of these have actually ever been detected. There could be hundreds of red and brown dwarfs closer to us than Proxima Centauri, the closest known star. So what's the closest star to our sun? We don't know the answer to that. The closest that we know of is Proxima Centauri. There could be dozens, if not hundreds, of closer stars. Someday we will be detecting them. Here's Mount Wilson, the observatory. There are a number of observatories there. This is the one that houses the Hooker 100-inch telescope. Came online in 1917, the biggest telescope in the world until Palomar and the Hale telescope in 1948, which was the largest telescope until, actually, until 1976, when that Soviet telescope in the Caucasus came up. But that thing was so defective because it was not thick enough glass, and it was warped by thermal fluctuation and became almost unusable. So a lot of lists just pass over that, and Hooker was not surpassed until Keck in the 1990s. So here I am standing by the Hooker telescope on a recent trip, and there is the chair right there that Edwin Hubble sat in to observe. They leave it there. I talked to an 85-year-old curator. He gave me a personal tour for 3 hours, and he regaled me with all these stories. He was a kid. His dad was a professional astronomer there. He grew up as a child knowing Alan Sandage, Edwin Hubble, Albert Einstein. He said, Hubble was not that big a deal. Alan Sandage, I said, well, who was a big deal? And he said, Milton Humason, the janitor. And also Alan Sandage, a creative astronomer, a creative genius, not just a chronicler like Hubble. And he said, Hubble never said the universe is expanding. Everybody said that's what he said, but he never did, because he had seen so many theories in astronomy shot down by later evidence. He didn't want to go down in history as the father of a failed theory. I said, what about Einstein? He had no interest in astronomy. He said, he'd take one and got the eyepiece. He had no interest at all. Boy, how many times I've said this to people. You know this. The population can be divided into two groups. About 95% of people will look through your telescope at a galaxy 100 million light years away, a little oval, or the Virgo cluster 60 million light years away, maybe a dozen galaxies in the field, and say, oh, that's nice. Where's my video game? But about 5%, 1 in 20 approximately, 1 in 5, 1 in 20, 1 in 10, will look at that same object, and they're changed for life. Isn't that true? That's what happened to me when I was in high school. I didn't have any interest in astronomy, but my brother obtained a cheap 4 1/4-inch reflector for his birthday. And he'd be out in the backyard every clear night. He kept begging me to come out. I was like Einstein. I had no interest. But one night he was so insistent that I went out, and there he had Saturn in the eyepiece. And it was seeing the ring around the planet. It just was an incredible reaction on my part. It launched within me a lifelong passion for astronomy, that singular event. And I've had people at my driveway, as you have, that have had the same experience. It's not most, it's not many, but there's some. I had an attorney come over one night, and I was out in the driveway. Let me take a look through there. And he was there for about 5 minutes, and he drove off. I didn't think it was any big deal. A year later, I saw him. He said that night was one of the top 5 experiences of my life. So you never know, do you? Einstein was in the larger group that was not impressed by looking at things through a telescope. I found that, I got that on good authority from Bill. You know, he was 85 years old. What a treasure. And you can't see it here, but on the other side of this reflector or refractor, there was a Telrad glued to the side of that telescope. I thought, oh, yeah, I can work this thing. You know, they ought to put that in their advertisements. Wouldn't that be a great marketing tool? Yeah, Mount Wilson, or the 100-inch Hooker telescope uses Telrads. How about you? You know, I don't know. Maybe the Hubble telescope has one. Maybe the Keck. Wouldn't that be great? So here we are, 1917. The 100-inch Hooker telescope completed at Mount Wilson, California. There it is. Largest telescope in the world from 1917 to 1948. In 1923, Hubble detects Cepheid variables in M31, our standard candles. He discovers them. And here's one of the photographic plates in Hubble's own handwriting, VAR, exclamation point. He found a Cepheid variable. What was the significance of that? He now had the means to measure the distance to a galaxy by means of what Shapley had discovered just 5 or 6 years before in 1917. And that's exactly what Hubble does. He estimates, after having discovered a number of Cepheids, measuring their apparent magnitude, and then using the inverse square law determining their absolute magnitude, using the distance modulus of M, capital M and small m, absolute and apparent magnitude, using Shapley's own equation and table, he computes the distance to M31, the Andromeda Galaxy, to be 900,000 light years. He did not take into account stellar absorption. We know that that's off by about a factor of three. But it was big enough to know this thing is not only huge, but it's far away. He's able to resolve individual stars in the Andromeda Galaxy and finds that he was looking for the he could care about it. Finding individual stars was important because it showed that this object was stellar, not gaseous, like Shapley thought. They were clouds of gas being, you know, affected by light pressure. But he is able to determine it consists of a multitude of countless stars. And when he found the Cepheids, he knew he could measure the distance. Later confirmed the true nature of spiral nebulae by resolving individual stars and photographs of M31 taken with the Hooker telescope. It's not an overstatement to say that Hubble discovered the universe. He discovered that it is a universe of galaxies. It's not one big blob like Shapley thought. There's only one galaxy in the universe. It's a menagerie of galaxies, and we know that to be the case. We look at the Hubble Ultra Deep Field taken a few years ago. 11.3 day observation over the course of several months, 200 plus hours of observation out of a small star poor region in the constellation Fornax, southern hemisphere. Hardly anything was there, nothing of interest, hardly any galaxies could be seen. And that lengthy exposure produces a menagerie of thousands of galaxies in an area the size of a straw at arm's length. What an amazing feat. It is a universe of galaxies. And so Hubble discovers this, and he puts it all in a letter to Harlow Shapley, his findings. And this is one of the inserts in his letter showing variable number one in Messier 31, its light curve, proving that it was a Cepheid variable, and using Shapley's own equation showing that it was 900,000 light years away. The universe consists of galaxies. There are countless of them. It's not just one, Shapley. You're wrong. That letter arrives at Harvard University, where Shapley had been teaching for the last couple of years. He's in his office talking to Cecilia Payne, the first PhD student in astronomy at Harvard University, a female. And the letter is delivered by Shapley's assistant because it came from Hubble. So he opens it on the spot. He receives this information. He studies it. He puts the letter down, and he says to Cecilia, "Here is the letter that destroyed my universe." It did, didn't it? It destroyed his view. It destroyed his conception of the universe as articulated in the Great Debate. The universe is not one galaxy. It's very much different than that, incomparably different. It's a universe that many of you have seen that consists of countless galaxies. We now know what those little ovals, those blurry ovals that we see in our telescopes or on our images, we know what those are now. They're not wisps of hydrogen gas a short distance away in our galaxy. Now we have the means of measuring their distance using Shapley's own discoveries of Cepheid variables in the distance modulus equation, coupled with Hubble and his findings of resolving stars and galaxies and determining the distance to some of these galaxies using the distance modulus equation, we know that the universe is a very different place than conceived of not too long ago by Harlow Shapley. So the debate, going back to the main points, Shapley was wrong in saying that the diameter of the Milky Way was 300,000 light years, but he was right in his 40-minute presentation during the great debate. Both parties said some things that were right and some things that were wrong. Shapley was wrong about number one, but he was right about number two. The sun is not the center of the Milky Way. He was wrong on point number three, which was a critical point, that the Milky Way is not so large that it's the only galaxy in the universe. It is the universe. That was not correct. Very different from his conception. And he was wrong with number three, or number four, that the spiral nebulae are gas clouds being repelled by the Milky Way's light pressure. So he got one right and three wrong of his main points. How about Curtis? The diameter of the Milky Way is 30,000 light years. He was off, wasn't he? It's more like 100 to 120,000 light years. The sun is very close to the center of the galaxy. He was wrong. We're way out on the spar of a spiral arm. But he was right about this. And this is the high point of the debate, in my opinion, that the spiral nebulae are galaxies, island universes separate from ours. So when we look at a picture like the Hubble Deep Field, like this, it gives meaning to that image, doesn't it? And this has all happened in the last 80 years or so. Conclusions. By 1924, just a few years after the Great Debate, astronomers understood that the spiral nebulae lie outside our own galaxy, and that they are, in fact, other galaxies, some of them very much like our own. In the previous decade, Shapley had multiplied the size of the universe by about 10 times. Hubble multiplied it far more. Hubble's universe was no longer the one enormous galaxy envisioned by Shapley. It was now understood to be composed of countless galaxies spread out in space, farther than the largest telescope could see. Hubble would next show that the universe is not static, as nearly everyone then believed, but is expanding. What he had made infinite in space, he would make finite in time. So, in conclusion, it's because of this great debate that resonated until resolved by Hubble in the 1920s, that when we today look through our obsessions, our Dobsonians, our refractors, our reflectors, and we see these little smudges, we now know what they are. Don't take that for granted. That was a long process to come to that point, and one of the greatest astronomers in the 20th century missed it as recently as 1920. And it was only because of that Hooker telescope on Mount Wilson, used by a gifted observer, Edwin Hubble, that we're able to literally learn the nature of the universe. And that concludes my presentation. I think of that every time I view galaxies. When I take wide-angle images of the Virgo cluster, for example, with my FSQ-106 refractor, Takahashi refractor, and I'm looking at a large area of that cluster, and in a 30-second image, I can count 100-plus galaxies, and to see these little smudges and to know what I'm looking at, we owe a debt to Edwin Hubble. So anyway, that concludes my presentation, and if you want to just have a few questions, I'll be glad to respond. Question? Only questions that I know the answer to, please.
What happened to Curtis's career?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. What happened to Curtis's career? Curtis went on to be the director of a number of observatories. He was highly respected until his death. He died, I believe, in 1938. And nothing was mentioned in his obituary about the Great Debate. The Great Debate was literally forgotten, like Mendelssohn in music. He was resurrected, or Bach, I mean, was resurrected by Mendelssohn in significant ways. But the interesting one to me is Shapley. Well, not Shapley. Let me go back and talk about Well, I can mention Shapley. He died in 1972. He lived several years. He was on the staff at Harvard University for many years. He never really talked about the Great Debate in his later years, other than to say on one occasion he thought Einstein was in attendance. But he did confide in friends. They would later record in their journals his embarrassment and humiliation at being so wrong on such a fundamental point. But he never said that publicly. The kind of the interesting character is George Hale himself, who was the chief organizer, developer for those three huge telescopes, the 60 and the 100-inch on Mount Wilson and the Hale telescope at Palomar. He had a number of mental disorders, including insomnia, which is not a bad disorder for an astronomer. But Dale has that. And, man, this last several nights, I've been up three nights out of four, you know, getting 3 hours of sleep. But you have to do what you have to do. I mean, we're getting these perfect nights under clear sky clock. I mean, you're out there. Yeah. But, you know, just like Marcus Aurelius said in his Meditations, Bill Clinton's favorite book, I've read it. I recommend it. It's one of the great books in Western literature. One of the lines in there is, there'll be plenty of time to sleep in the grave. And I often think about that. What do you want to go to sleep for when it's excellent seeing? You know, get back out there. But he also had schizophrenia, and he believed that an invisible elf had personally advised him for most of his life. And because of his mental aberrations, he was forced out, literally, at Mount Wilson and died a number of years later. But it's kind of a pathetic and sad end to really a great organizer. He did have mental disease, and it's a tragic end to a great astronomer to whom we owe a debt of gratitude, because without him, you just wonder if the 60, the 100-inch, and the Hale 200, would they have ever been funded and organized and developed? Certainly not when he did them. It would have been much later, I fear. Any other questions on the Great Debate? Yes, sir.
Just a couple questions. One is, because I think earlier in the lecture you said that the septic variables were discovered by this deaf mute. Is that what you said?
Yes, John Goodrick.
The ancients never figured that out, just through simple observation with some of the naked eye stars?
They may have. I don't know of any conclusive evidence of that. Goodrick is given the place in science of the first person that we know that discovered a variable star. I don't know if anybody knows of anybody. I mean, certainly in modern times that's true. Whether somebody in the ancient world was that could actually notice variability in one star out of the multitude of stars may have. Just like, for example, the ancient world did discover the Andromeda Galaxy. I mean, we know that. But I don't know of any ancient accounts of anybody detecting a variable star. Okay. Pleasure.